This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. A victory for Republicans after a judge demands the State Elections Commission to remove its guidance that allowed clerks to cure absentee ballot envelopes. Plus, Wisconsin ranks the lowest in the country for providing state aid to police departments. How both candidates in the governor's race want to provide more resources if elected. And less than 8 weeks until Election Day, statewide polling takes a dramatic shift favoring Ron Johnson in the U.S. Senate race. What pollsters say is the reason behind it. All this and more on Rewind, your week in review for September 16th. Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
J.R., this week we're going to start with a continuation of a story regarding curing absentee ballot envelopes. Now, to be clear, we are not talking about someone's ballot or changing someone's vote. It is the envelope on the outside that has been an issue about clerks filling in missing address information for the witness that signs those. So, earlier this week, a Waukesha County judge basically doubled down on an earlier decision that says the Wisconsin Elections Commission needs to change and withdraw its guidance from 2016 that allowed clerks to cure absentee ballots. So the commission met later in the week, and they voted 4-1 to withdraw that rule to comply with the judge's ruling. Now, before they got into their debate on this issue, Don Millis, who is the chair, a Republican, on the Elections Commission, basically kind of said, hey, before we get debating on this topic, we need to comply with this. Almost said it's going to be a death wish if we don't. We might get sued. So let's just take a listen from here, from him real quick, and then we'll kind of dive more into the details about this decision.
There's no secret that the commission has been a lightning rod for criticism from lots of people. And it seems to me that if we're not going to withdraw the guidance, it's like a death wish for the commission. It seems to me that some of us were gung-ho to go and do to fully embrace Judge Peterson's decision last week, and here we have a situation where we're trying to split hairs and say, well, we're not really withdrawing. They didn't tell us to take off the four words "and have been withdrawn." They didn't. Is that correct, Jim and Brandon?
They did not. No.
So it seems to me that "and have been withdrawn" is the logical implication of the court's injunction.
We're not ordered to withdraw the guidance. I think the guidance was right and accurate. And I disagree with you that we have to read tea leaves from a judge who wrote a very explicit order that he didn't know that he meant to say, you are thereby ordered to withdraw the guidance. I'm fairly confident that he knew exactly what he was doing, because he used all sorts of specific terms in the conjunctive to, advise, guide, instruct, publish, communicate. So if he wanted us to withdraw, I'm confident he knew that that was what he wanted us to do.
So we talked about this last week. We knew this decision was coming. We knew WEC had to withdraw its guidance to comply with the judge's ruling. But to put into perspective, too, of how many individuals actually leave missing information, the Legislative Audit Bureau actually did an audit last year, and they reviewed 15,000 absentee ballot envelopes from the 2020 election from about 30 municipalities. And it only found about a little over 1,000. That's about 7% were missing some information. That can be a zip code. That can be just the WI for Wisconsin. Milwaukee also did this as well. They found less than 1% of absentee ballots cast in April were missing in address information. So it's really, really small, but it still puts clerks in a really tough position, because they're ultimately going to have to decide, or they're actually voting on their own, whether what to tell their clerks, that if it's just a zip code, go ahead and do it, or it's really going to depend across the state if another clerk says, nope, that doesn't count.
So big picture, we're not sure how much of an impact this is going to have on November, because we are voting in fewer numbers absentee than we were in 2020 for obvious reasons. And two, you would hope we're getting better at it. And we've been through several elections now where people who vote absentee know what's required. So it remains to be seen how big of a deal this is. Also, because there may be an appeal of this judge's decision barring curing of absentee ballots. We're waiting for that. It's also days away from the election, which means clerks are having a very difficult time right now with the changing rules constantly. The challenge about clean address is we don't have a definition in state law or in rule. We have guidance. Remember, State law is passed by lawmakers, signed by the governor, in the books. Rules are agencies like the Elections Commission filling the blanks of state law to apply it to what's going on and then submitting it to lawmakers and the governor for review. Carries the weight of state law. The guidance does not. The guidance approved in 2016, the subject of this court hearing, has been withdrawn when it comes to curing absentee ballots. That same guidance included a passage with the Elections Commission saying, a complete address is this. Here are our parameters. But it's just guidance. We had a luncheon this week. Dan Cunningham clerk Scott McDonald said their Board of Canvass voted unanimously to accept absentee ballot envelopes that don't have a zip code. All right? Because in theory, if I mail something to you with your name, address, city, and state, it'll get there. Maybe not get there on time, but it'll get there, right? Zip code, not a problem. The Portage city clerk was also at our luncheon and said they had a vote, and it was a majority, but not unanimous, to accept those ballots. But what about everybody else? There's not a clear standard for clerks. Yes, they have that guidance, but it's up to them what they want to do in terms of what's a complete address, which also means post-November, if we have a tight race again and there's no clear guidance or rule or law, that you could have challenges to absentee ballots cast that may be missing a zip code or missing a blank. So let's imagine a 20,000 vote race for governor and Dane County has 21,000 absentee ballots without a zip code on them. What do you think is going to happen in that scenario, right? So I may just throw stuff out there, but this is the challenge and the rub of what's going on right now.
And it's also important to note this was never really an issue with Republicans or Democrats until after the 2020 election. Republicans didn't have a problem with filling in, you know, missing addresses, zip codes, etc. But it did become an issue, of course, as many voting issues and how our elections are run is when after Trump's loss here in the battleground.
Don Millis, the chair of the Elections Commission, made the motion in 2016 that was approved unanimously to cure absentee ballots. Also worth noting, this is the second time in as many weeks that the retired clerks on the Elections Commission broke partisan ranks to approve a motion. Mm-hmm. So you had last week a retired Republican clerk siding with Democrats to approve a guidance on complying with a federal judge's ruling about assistance for disabled voters. So you don't have to provide ID or sign anything when you show up to drop off a ballot. This week, the retired Dem clerk siding with Republicans to withdraw the guidance, not just like do what they wanted to do, like include the language from the ruling in this motion. So I was a Republican. So it's notable that maybe they're getting tired.
Because I know just us as reporters, we always, well, not always, but we kind of just predict that it's going to be a 3-3 partisan line vote. But we've had just some of those two instances that you notice is that kind of took us by surprise, because usually we say it's going to be an uphill battle if WEC, you know, agrees on something, because their meetings usually go hours, and then a motion fails. But it seems to be shifting ever since Don Millis became chair.
Bob Spindell last week was surprised, unhappy that the GOP clerk broke ranks. This week ahead of the vote, he warned his fellow GOP appointees, we should not break rank, we should not compromise on this issue. So just worth noting.
Yep. Also this week, of course, we know crime and violent crime is a big issue in the governor's race, and I should also say the U.S. Senate race. A lot of Republicans really honing on this issue on the campaign trail. So this week, Tim Michaels signaled his support for his law enforcement package, of course, touted it on the steps with some members of the Milwaukee Police Association. And of course, he has a lot of ideas that he wants to do. Of course, you know, bolstering police departments and, you know, cracking down on communities that defund the police, etc. But one big thing that we didn't hear from him is how does he want to pay for this package? So many of us reporters asked him that question. He once floated using some of the state surplus, as we know it's projected to be over $5 billion that is just sitting there. The Republican lawmakers, of course, don't want to touch until next year and decide who's going to be their governor. But he also said he's willing to give local governments more state aid to counter rising crime and bolster police departments, which is a revenue boost that Republicans have previously opposed in other state budgets. And of course, Milwaukee leaders and Milwaukee lawmakers have long asked the state legislature to allow them to raise their sales tax. One of the proposals was allowed to raise it by 1%, basically to get more shared revenue for things like fire, police, and other essential services. Let's first just hear from Tim Michaels about him being asked about this and basically him saying he's willing to work with GOP lawmakers if elected.
Everywhere I go, I hear that crime is the number one issue for people. If it's not number one, it's number one or number two. And it is for me as well as governor. I believe that there is a lot of money in the state budget. There's $43.5 billion that are spent every year in the state budget. If we have to spend a little bit more money to make law enforcement more effective, to hire more police officers, absolutely we will do that. There is a projected $5.4 billion budget surplus right now. So what are we going to do with that extra money? Number one, we're going to lower taxes so people aren't being overtaxed. Number two, we'll sit down with the legislature. We'll decide what the appropriate amount of money is for law enforcement, because it is one of my biggest priorities. It's one of the biggest priorities of the taxpaying, hardworking, law-abiding citizens of Wisconsin.
So one of the questions I asked Michaels at that press avail is that Wisconsin is currently lagging across the country for state funding for police departments. Wisconsin actually ranks dead last across the country for that on spending on police. So I said, you know, do you think it's a failure of lawmakers not adequately funding? He kind of danced around that question. And like you just heard him say, that he's open and willing to work with lawmakers on this. But this is also what's interesting note about using more state dollars on law enforcement is that this has been something that Governor Evers and Democrats have long asked for. So it's at least one thing that they can agree on when it comes to this issue.
Oh, you're hearing some Dem messaging trying to say that this has been their effort to fund police and Republicans are opposed to it. Shared revenue has been flat or declining pretty much since I got here. I mean, if you look at inflation, that kind of factor that in. But yes, this is the Democratic answer to funding police, trying to put more state aid into local governments, which face property tax caps that prohibit them from raising revenues beyond basically new growth to pay for services like police.
And we're going to stick on the governor's race and do some of the highlights from the latest Marquette University Law School poll. And if there's one key takeaway from the governor's race and the U.S. Senate race that we'll get into a little bit is, JR, breaking news, it's going to be tight, right? All right. So let's pull up the slide right here with the matchup between Evers and Michaels. Among likely voters, Evers has 47%, Michaels 44%. Registered voters, 44% for Evers, 43% backing Michaels. Now, what I think, you know, there was no real huge shift in the numbers here compared to August's results. But one thing that I found interesting is that Evers, for only the second time since he's been sworn into office, his approval rating did decline. And that was the first time, I think, since February of this year. So it's been slowly on the decline, but it's only the second times more people disapprove of his job performance than approve.
Yeah, so warning signs for Evers, upside down for job approval. His fave, unfave is now even. His reputation is a likable guy who's not a bomb thrower, not going to really, you know, be kind of like a Scott Walker type governor. So those are not great. The red flag for Michaels is that his unfavorable is ticked up by 6 points. People will tell you that there's sometimes a lag between favorables moving and the head-to-head moving. Michaels also has a lot of room to grow in terms of like his negatives. He's still not that well known. We reported last week, it was politics, that from last week through Election Day, Evers and his supporters are on pace to outspend Michaels and his 3-1 on TV. Now, it's not the same volume as what's happened in the Senate race. That is a lot more going on there. But you are seeing the impact of those ads on Michaels because negatives are going up. Michaels obviously spent $12 million in the primary. He has struggled to get donors to realize he's not going to pay for the primary, or the general election, I should say, get them on board to help him cover those costs. Because the joke that I heard last week was, how do you get millionaires to give a billionaire a check, right? Mm-hmm. So unless you change that dynamic, even in a good environment for you, you are in a difficult position. The challenge of the Michaels campaign is to not get to parity necessarily, but not be 3-1 in terms of being outspent pre-now election day, because Evers will continue to define him on abortion and issues like that. You saw an ad from Michaels this week. They're throwing the kitchen sink at me. These things are flying at him, you know, as he's walking through talking about all this stuff happening. Okay, cutesy ad, but you're also seeing Evers hit him and his supporters on abortion in a way that Republicans feel like the issues are on their side. Crime, inflation, the environment are on their side. But if you want to win back over college-educated suburban women on crime, for example, how do you do that when Michaels is being defined on abortion over and over again, these ads that they're seeing repeatedly?
And it's kind of interesting about those two topics, too. It seems like crime has been working in Senator Ron Johnson's favor, because that's really what he's been pushing a lot against his opponent, Mandela Barnes. So let's shift to that. That is the MU poll right now. Ron Johnson, just last month, I mean, he was behind 7 points to Mandela Barnes. That changed dramatically. Mm-hmm. Huge shift there. Ron Johnson now leading in the race in the latest poll, 49% to Mandela Barnes, 48%. And, you know, we also heard pollster Charles Franklin, who's the director of this poll, really hone in on the negative ads, really did make a difference in this big shift that we saw. And also, you know, I would agree that a lot of people have really just made up their mind about Ron Johnson. Mm-hmm. They know who he is, and Mandela doesn't really have that same name recognition. So when they see those ads, it clearly is resonating with people that, oh, Mandela Barnes wants to hurt families, or, you know, just those messagings that we're seeing, or he's soft on crime, etc. So it clearly is making a difference here.
Voters don't have a favorable impression of Ron Johnson. His key is, can he make them have a less favorable impression of Mandela Barnes? So far, things are shifting now. The Michaels numbers went up 6 points for negatives. Barnes went up 10 points. The difference between two of them was nobody took a shot at Mandela Barnes in the primary, right? There was no attack yet on him, whereas Michaels had some thrown at him by Rebecca Clayfish, so he went through that kind of process. Barnes had all but basically positive stuff going for him in that last poll. Now we're seeing a change. Now, honestly, I never thought we were going to see a 7-point Senate race in Wisconsin with an incumbent.
Right.
Not going to happen. So maybe just kind of get it back to normal. But the question is, how does Barnes counter this barrage of negative ads? And Democrats will tell you they feel like there's some racial undertones here. If you look at the spots, Barnes is often paired with the squad from Congress, all people of color. The grainy videos of people committing crimes are often black. They feel like that's, you know, a little bit on purpose. Either way, it's working. It's driving up Barnes's negatives. How does he counter that? The best answer I heard this week was, present a positive, forward-looking vision about minimum wage, about the economy, manufacturing, things that people care about, pocketbook issues. Show them that you're like this upbeat guy that's going to go fight for the middle class. That's your best shot. To maybe counter this narrative, it also would help if the negative attacks on Johnson keep them neck and neck. We saw more today from Senate Majority PAC about Johnson in terms of abortion. A new one says that prices are going up, right? Johnson's trying to claim the high ground of inflation. This new ad says prices are going up, the grocery store, the gas station, and who profits? Oil companies, big corporations, and Ron Johnson. Ron Johnson profits off of corporations that invest in China. He's breaking in the dough off of this stuff, trying to make this turn around on him a little bit. Nothing's going to work, but it's interesting to see how they're trying to play this issue for Johnson.
And just for everyone's well-being, I guess, just be prepared for a lot more ads.
Yes, yeah.
They are only going to ramp up even more about 2 weeks out from Election Day. Also, an update, speaking on the top. Oh, excuse me. I'm going out of order here. I apologize. Staying with the poll before we get to the issue on abortion. Also, the issues among the top concern among voters. We didn't really see much change here at all. Inflation, of course, remains the number one. Then crime. Accurate vote count actually got up there, which was kind of a change from August poll as well. Public schools. And, you know, no big surprise, matched up with August as well, that coronavirus is less of a concern on many voters. So, you know, I think inflation, we've seen it. I mean, we just talked about it. It's in ads. People are talking about it. Crime, people are talking about it. So I think, you know, no big headline out of those concerns.
So the abortion one's the interesting question. How much is it going to play in November? And talking to Republicans, I feel like, you know, crime and inflation will crowd it out. Look at the crosstabs of the Marquette poll. 85% of women are concerned about abortion policy. It doesn't have to be the top issue. What it has to be a driver is, does it change the vote of a key constituency who's going to go one place but now goes another? That's what I don't know. We saw when push came to shove on votes in Kansas, special elections elsewhere, it was a moving issue. So will it be a moving issue a month and a half from now, 2 months from now, or is it starting to lose one's legs because we're getting farther off from the Dobbs decision? That I don't know, but I can bet you're going to hear about it continually in TV ads between now and Election Day.
And there was also that effort in Congress, too, that kind of quickly went under the radar. It popped up really big of a possible national, a proposal, I should say, for a national abortion ban, and that quickly fizzled out. I don't think that's going to come up for a vote this year, but it almost just brought up back up the debate. And it was almost kind of a little surprising that they were going to do it this close to the midterms. But, you know, maybe they thought it was going to work to their favor to rile up their base. Staying on the topic of abortion, I was going out of order, but we have a lawsuit, of course, that is pending right now with the Evers administration challenging the 1849 criminal abortion ban that would ban all abortions unless the mother's life is at risk. So basically, the update is that Attorney General Josh Call kind of basically threatened GOP lawmakers that if they don't drop their challenge to this case, to dismiss it, they're asking to dismiss this, that he's going to go after the DAs and file lawsuits against them individually instead. Now, GOP leaders have long argued that they made this law, but they don't enforce it, so they shouldn't be the ones that are being sued here. You know, we'll see what happens. I believe today was the deadline that Josh Call gave lawmakers to respond. I checked in with the Attorney General's office this morning, didn't really have any updates, but that could be something, maybe a development for next week, JR.
Yeah, actually, deadline was yesterday.
Oh, deadline was yesterday, excuse me.
So basically, I'm just saying you're suing the wrong people, and that's why it should be dismissed. We shall see what Call does next with this. This lawsuit, remember, was filed in late June, if I remember correctly. It's now mid-September. There's been not a hearing yet on it, so it's not moving very quickly at this point.
Right. All right, stock picks this week. We have rising. Secretary of State Doug LaFollette had a little fundraising boost. He seems like he's getting out there a little bit more.
Emily, Doug LaFollette raised more money between July 26th and August 31st from individuals than he had in the previous 13.5 years combined.
Wow.
Yes. Now, the floor is very, very low, all right? So he raised about $89,000. Of that, $40,000 came from Steven Spielberg and actress Kate Upshaw, Capshaw, his wife, big chunk of it. I talked to LaFollette and asked, well, what did you do? And he said, nothing. He didn't make a single solicitation for fundraising during the period. What is happening is you're seeing national groups. There's a Democratic Association of Secretaries of State that is pushing races around this country, driving donors toward races. You probably have state and national parties doing the same thing, advocates saying, we must defend these offices. Now, the kind of secret is about Wisconsin, it doesn't really have anything to do with elections, right?
Right.
I mean, there's this process where the Secretary of State affixes the state seal to the presidential electors, but in terms of administering elections, there's no formal role. There is, however, a push by some to try and get them more involved. So that probably is what's driving the fundraising. Looking at Amy Loudenbeck, the Republican's report, she has not filed her report yet for the last reporting period. It's not due until September 27th. Doug just very early, apparently. She raised more money during the first part of the year than what Doug raised in this one window. I don't know if it really matters, to tell you the truth. The question is LaFollette's name still golden in Wisconsin politics? Because you think about the millions being spent in the race for Senate, the millions, not quite as many millions, for governor. Get down to Secretary of State. Who's going to know these guys come, you know, election day? Loudenbeck raised between January 1st and July 25th $130,000. Okay, great. That is not enough for a sustained TV campaign statewide. Will some Republican group come in and run one? I don't know. We also have lawmakers, the clear, you know, consensus what they want to do with election administration. Do they want to have the office have a role or not? We shall see. But for Democrats, they're ginning up the fear of these election deniers getting these offices. And Amy's not embraced, you know, some of the stuff that's been out there, but ginning up the fear of these election deniers getting spots in key offices around the country, especially your Arizonas, your Pennsylvanias, your Michigans, to probably drive this fundraising for Doug.
All right. And mixed this week, we have Tammy Baldwin. And the topic, of course, is this codifying the same-sex marriage, gay marriage bill into law. And it doesn't seem like it's going to be coming up for a vote anymore.
No, I mean, when this first was pushed, this is post-Dobbs decision. Mm-hmm. Baldwin and others began working on this. She had a lot of positive media out of this effort, right, because it looked like she actually had momentum to get Republicans on the side, in part because Ron Johnson said, I see no reason to oppose this bill.
That quickly changed.
Yes. Fast forward, the election started getting closer and things started to change.
Yeah.
So Johnson told people actually he's got concerns about religious institutions, how this religious freedom, how it impact them. There's been work on an amendment to try and address those concerns. Johnson's now saying, I see no reason for this bill. You'll never overturn the gay marriage ruling. Tell that to abortion supporters, by the way, with Roe v. Wade. And Johnson, actually, there was some audio the Journal Sentinel got of him saying he basically gave that answer in July to get reporters off my back. So now we have, there was a push this week to get it to the floor and get an actual vote, a procedural vote. You need 60 votes on cloture for a filibuster. You get past that, you're the vote. Baldwin says, I think I got 10 people, 10 Republicans, who will support a final passage, but that cloture motion may be a sticking point. We're going to wait till after the election now to do it, hoping that that changes the temperature on this thing. Okay. On the one hand, for backers, it lessens the Republican fear of this is a political thing to make them look bad ahead of the election. The downside, though, is what happens if Republicans flip the chamber November 8th? Starting November 9th, if you're going to be back in control, what's the incentive for Republicans to vote for a Democratic effort? Now, granted, you have Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine, is one of the main kind of co-authors of this effort. What's your incentive to back this bill post-election day if they're not in control anymore,
right.
Even if it is
right.
Wildly popular? So there's this yin and yang for Baldwin, but she's gotten some good press for being behind this effort and seeming to be on the verge of getting something done. So she can actually pull it off.
And there's also been the argument from Republicans that no one's going to go after gay marriage. It's, you know, it's settled. The issue is, you know, it's a non-starter. It's over with. But, you know, there's that Supreme Court leak kind of just did give a hint that other rights could possibly be at risk.
Well, and Clarence Thomas writes in his concurring opinion, this decision should be looked at. Now, granted, it was him. It wasn't everybody in the court. But
correct.
That definitely got people's attention.
Exactly. And then falling this week is debates. Reported last week that the governors will just do one debate. Mm-hmm. We're still unclear on the U.S. Senate race, how many they'll do, even if one. But, J.R., you actually found some interesting statistics that about the only governors deciding to do one this year.
It is the first time since 1998 that there will only be one debate among the major governor candidates. Now, going back over the years, there were two in 2018 with Evers and Walker, two in 14 with Walker and Mary Burke. There were three in 2010. 2006, there were, I think, three. 2002, there were four, although they didn't include everybody. There was Ed Thompson, Libertarian at that time, and Jim Young, a Green Party candidate. A couple were just Doyle and McCallum. A couple had all four of them. In 1998, Tommy Thompson was going for a fourth term. He won his third with two-thirds of the vote. Ed Garvey, the Democrat, really didn't have much of a shot. That race never took off. There was no incentive for Tommy to do a debate with him, more than one. Debates have changed the last 24 years. Now, it's not about the debate. It's about avoiding the gaffe, right? Avoiding the viral moment that shows up in a TV ad or on social media that makes you look bad. So in talking to people, their feeling was, actually, there's incentive for both Evers and Michaels who only want to do one. For Evers, you avoid elevating the opponent to your equal, right? You're both on stage. It gives the opportunity for Michaels to be like, have that same footing as the incumbent. That's always a risk there. For Michaels, he did clean up after both those primary debates, mostly on President Trump. You're avoiding more than one chance to have that gaffe that comes back to haunt you. Now, the downside for Evers is, as governor, he, of course, should have much stronger command of like what's happening in state government because he's run government for almost 4 years now.
Correct.
Michaels hasn't had that. If you watch Michaels on a lot of his interviews, he talks about, I'll get back to you. I'll check into this when I ask about specifics. So there's that. The Senate race, though, it's a different dynamic from what people tell me. Johnson probably wants more than one debate with Mandela Barnes because he keeps chastising Mandela as hiding from the media, as hiding from the public, as not wanting to answer questions. It's a chance to put Mandela on the defensive to try and really goad him into answering stuff. The flip side is, if you're Barnes, yes, doing just one or two would avoid more chances for problems. But also, if you're being pinned as this guy who's afraid, if you hold your own, you could flip that script and really show, hey, I've got command of the issues. I'm not hiding. I'm here. I know what's going on. So there could be real upside for you. So we'll watch how that goes. Over in the third CD, we have the more traditional dynamic going on. Derek Van Orden, a Republican, came close to Ron Kind in 2020, back again, heavily favored. The seat is the most likely to flip, according to the national prognosticators, in terms of partisan hands. He has no incentive to debate Brad Paff three times. Brad Paff issued a challenge this week, three debates, otherwise Derek, basically you're yellow. Now you face me three times. Yesterday, Brad accepted an invite from a group that includes UW La Crosse to debate. This morning, Van Orden says, I think the media and people across, they're all biased. You know, I'm not going to do a debate with them. I'll only debate in a town hall style setting where the voters ask the questions, not this biased media and these academics. I'm not going to hold my breath for a number of for three debates in the third congressional district.
Right.
But that's an example of if you're in the lead, don't give your other guy oxygen to try and take it away from you.
Right. And it's going to just a little bit fewer chances for the public and for the media mm-hmm. to report on a lot of issues that, you know, us as reporters can't always ask the candidates when they're in town or et cetera. So it should be interesting. At least we'll get one in the governor's debate as well. All right. That will do it for this week. My name is Emily Fannin. I'm wrapping up for this week.
I'm J.R. Ross.
Have a good weekend.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.